Our final speaker is James Seaton of Michigan State University, who will talk on Irving Babbitt and cultural renewal.
Thank you. I'd like to thank Class Wren for inviting me to speak here and be part of this very distinguished panel and speakers before and to appear before this audience. It's my first Philadelphia Society, and I'm extremely impressed. And what have I been doing all these years not coming to it? But let me begin. Irving Babbitt. The only thing he said was I had to talk about Irving Babbitt. So, but I wanted to. It is tempting to think of Irving Babbitt as a voice crying in the wilderness, a lonely prophet attempting the impossible task of reversing the course of history. Such a view of Babbitt has the bonus of imputing a special virtue to those few, like ourselves, who are able to appreciate his real importance. Indeed, to think of Babbitt in this way is not entirely wrong. He did take unpopular stands, and he did oppose what he saw as the dominant trends of modern thought, Baconian naturalism and Rousseauian romanticism. Attractive though such a view might be, however, it should be rejected. Babbitt himself was uninterested in the consolations of defeat. The romance of the lost cause was not for him. Though he was unsparing in his criticism of the laxities of American culture, Irving Babbitt was unwilling to concede that contemporaries like John Dewey were somehow more American than he. When American progressives looked to Jefferson for inspiration, Babbitt turned to George Washington and John Marshall. When American Babbitt argued that his own politics were in the Unionist tradition of Whitman's hero, Abraham Lincoln. Well, just as he refused to surrender American politics to his adversaries, Babbitt refused to be categorized as a philosophical traditionalist or reactionary. Instead, he insisted that it was he who was the true modernist. He argued that, quoting, the whole modern experiment is threatened with breakdown simply because it has not been sufficiently modern. Babbitt identified himself wholeheartedly with the, I'm quoting again, the modern spirit, the positive and critical spirit, the spirit that refuses to take things on authority. Thus, for example, Babbitt's criticism of Romanticism does not rely on any prior acceptance of classical literary standards or even traditional morality, but rather on the promise of the movement, the failure of the movement to live up to its own promises. Babbitt points out, the Rousseauist seeks happiness, and yet on his own showing, his mode of seeking it results not in happiness, but in wretchedness. A movement which began by asserting the goodness of man and the loveliness of nature ended by producing the greatest literature of despair the world has ever seen. Well, to assess the significance of Babbitt's intellectual legacy, it is more fruitful to consider the ways in which Babbitt's new humanism provides a context that allows us to organize otherwise scattered insights into a coherent perspective rather than to present him as a lonely genius. The power of Babbitt's thought can be gauged from its ability to integrate ideas from a polemical adversary like George Santayana, from a champion of political liberalism like Lionel Trilling, and from a contemporary, often called postmodernist novelist, championed by Richard Rorty, Milan Kundera. Well, Babbitt certainly never lacked for polemical adversaries. In 1930, an anthology of attacks on the new humanism appeared. According to C. Hartley Grattan, the editor of the anthology, Babbitt and the other humanists were such obscurantists that they rejected, quoting, all scientific progress since Newton as largely false. Malcolm Cowley, one of the contributors, posed what he considered an unanswerable question to Babbitt and his colleagues. What validity did the new humanism have, quoting, for the mill hands of New Bedford and Gastonia, for the beet toppers of Colorado, for the men who tighten a single screw in the automobiles that march along Mr. Ford's assembly belt? Another of the contributors characterized the new humanism as, quoting, little more than a rationalization of neophobia and a piece of special pleading for the genteel tradition. Well, the notion of a genteel tradition, of course, originated with George Santayana. Observing that the chief fountains of this tradition were Calvinism on the one hand and transcendentalism on the other, Santayana had argued that the attempt to fuse such radically opposed points of view could lead only to intellectual confusion. Well, since Babbitt was neither a Calvinist nor a transcendentalist, One might have expected that a philosopher would have protested against the misuse of his concept. Instead, Santayana piled on. He responded in 1931 by writing his own condemnation of Babbitt's New Humanism under the title The Genteel Tradition at Bay. From a very different point of view than Malcolm Cowley, Santayana posed a series of what were meant to be similarly unanswerable questions. Why not frankly rejoice in the benefits so new and extraordinary which our state of society affords? At least, besides football, haven't we Einstein and Freud, Proust and Paul Valéry, Lenin and Mussolini? Why should anyone be dissatisfied? Is it not enough that millionaires splendidly endow libraries and museums, that the democracy loves them, and that even the Bolsheviks prize the relics of Christian civilization? And perhaps most crushing of all, I can find little in their recommendations except a cautious allegiance to the genteel tradition. But can the way of Matthew Arnold and of Professor Norton, Charles Eliot Norton, be the way of life for all men forever? Well, anyone who was introduced to Santayana and Babbitt by the genteel tradition at Bay could be excused for assuming that the two must disagree about everything. And yet, Babbitt's critique of literary romanticism is confirmed by Santayana's own analysis of philosophical romanticism. Santayana's critique is much like Babbitt's own. Here I'm going to quote from Santayana. In various directions at once, we see today an intense hatred and disbelief gathering head against the very notion of a cosmos to be discovered or a stable human nature to be respected. Sounds kind of familiar. Nature, we are told, is an artificial symbol employed by life. Truth is a temporary convention. Art is an expression of personality. War is better than peace, effort than achievement, and feeling than intelligence. Change is deeper than form. Will is above morality. Well, what bothered Santayana was that Babbitt attempted to convince other people that art is more than an expression of personality, that feeling is no substitute for intelligence, that impulse should be restrained by morality. In his later philosophy, Santayana emphasized the importance of spirit, by which he meant the attempt to view, and I'm quoting again here, things as they are, disinterestedly, contemplatively, to take the point of view of God, of the truth, and of eternity, quote. According to Santayana, another quote, in philosophy, when ultimately the spirit comes face to face with the truth, convention and absurdity are out of place. So is humanism, and so is the genteel tradition, so is morality itself. Well, whether or not Santayana is right about this, for most of our lives, we are not engaged in solitary contemplation, face to face with the truth, but acting as members of families, societies, and states. If one chooses to take an active part in one's society and culture, then morality itself is no longer out of place. It'd be most unfortunate if the polemics of the genteel tradition at Bay led to the conclusion that one must choose between Santayana and Babbitt. It would be more accurate to say that Babbitt's New Humanism provides an example of what is possible when Santayana's real insights are made the basis for intellectual and cultural renewal. Well, Lionel Trilling, you may know, remember, famously began the liberal imagination with the assertion that, quote, in the United States at this time, liberalism is not only the dominant, but even the sole intellectual tradition. Trilling never discussed Babbitt, Paul Elmer Moore, the New Humanism in his essays. Even in his long book on Matthew Arnold, originally a doctoral dissertation, Trilling failed to consider Babbitt's view of Arnold in any substantive way. He did note, however, that F.O. Matheson, not Trilling, considered Babbitt one of, quoting, the continuators of the Arnold tradition. Now, it is true that Babbitt was one of the continuators of the Arnold tradition, though his admiration for Arnold wasn't by any means uncritical. Babbitt was explicit about his indebtedness to Arnold. One may be a continuator of a tradition, however, without declaring that allegiance. Trilling himself may be seen as a continuator of the Babbitt tradition, even though his few references to Babbitt are either neutral or hostile. In the February 2002 issue of Commentary, Gertrude Himmelfarb, mentioned in your talk, right, justifiably takes Richard Posner to task for, among other things, portraying Lionel Trilling as a critic torn between the moralist and aesthetic camps, when Trilling might be more accurately described as the prototype of the moral critic. She is quite possibly right to assert that Trilling exercised the moral imagination more effectively and imaginatively than any literary critic. And it's at least arguable that she's right in going on to say that he did so more than any public intellectual of the time. Miss Himmelfarb goes too far, however. She's wrong in asserting that it is he, Trilling, who coined the term moral imagination. The phrase, I don't need to tell this audience, is Edmund Burke's, from one of the most famous passages of his Reflections on the Revolution in France. Lamenting the ill treatment of Marie Antoinette, Burke comments that the age of chivalry has been replaced by a time of sophisters, economists, and calculators. Now Burke fears, quoting, all the decent drapery of life is to be rudely torn off. All the superadded ideas furnished from the wardrobe of a moral imagination, which the heart owns and the imagination ratifies, as necessary to cover the defects of our shivering, naked shivering nature, and to raise it to dignity in our own estimation, are to be exploded as a ridiculous, absurd, and antiquated fashion, unquote. Well, Trilling might have run across the phrase in Burke's Reflections, or more likely, I think, probably in Irving Babbitt's Democracy and Leadership, which came out in 1924 when he was, whose third chapter is entitled Burke and the Moral Imagination. Not merely the phrase, but the concept is central to Babbitt's thought. He believed that the only effective conservatism is an imaginative conservatism, because he recognized the supreme role of the imagination in human affairs. The second chapter of Democracy and Leadership is entitled Rousseau and the Idyllic Imagination. As the contrasting titles of the second and third chapters suggest, Babbitt saw the culture wars of his own day as not so much a battle of ideas as a struggle between opposing imaginative visions. That was why Babbitt spent more time analyzing romantic poetry than discussing romantic philosophers. It was the poets who could touch men's souls. Near the end of Rousseau and Romanticism, Babbitt comes back to the problem of the, here he calls it the ethical imagination, and argues that this problem is indeed, in a peculiar sense, the problem of civilization itself. Having identified himself with the critical spirit of modernity, Babbitt notes, quoting, a civilization that rests on dogma and outer authority cannot afford to face the whole truth about the imagination and its role. But he adds that a civilization in which dogma and outer authority have been undermined by the critical spirit not only can, but must do this very thing if it is to continue at all. The problem is so important because Babbitt believes that the truths on which civilization depends cannot finally be conveyed through abstract reason, but only through imaginative symbols, or you might say the myths that were discussed earlier today. When in the liberal imagination, Lionel Trilling argues that, quote, we stand in need of the moral realism which is the product of the free play of the moral imagination, and goes on to claim that for our time the most effective agent of the moral imagination has been the novel of the last 200 years, he is, whether he knew it or not, a continuator of the tradition of Irving Babbitt. Well, Richard Rorty attempts to enlist the novelists Milan Kundera and Charles Dickens in the postmodernist cause in an essay entitled Heidegger, Kundera, and Dickens. Well, Charles Dickens can take care of himself. He wrote too many books that have been read by too many people for too long to allow his reputation to be hijacked very easily. When, however, Rorty asserts that Milan Kundera's novels teach that, quote, it is comical to think that there is something called truth, capital T, which transcends pleasure and pain, unquote, many might assume that Rorty knows what he's talking about, if you haven't read Kundera. According to Rorty, Kundera's fiction reveals, quote, the essential relativity of human affairs, unquote, which for Rorty means that nobody has any more right than anybody else about anything. It is certainly easy to see why Rorty wants to interpret Kundera this way. It allows him to borrow the prestige of one of the most acclaimed and innovative of contemporary novelists for his own ideas. Trouble is, Kundera's novels, innovative in style, though they certainly are, and that's why they're sometimes they're called postmodernists, are much closer in spirit to Irving Babbitt than to Richard Rorty. For example, Kundera's novel, Life is Elsewhere, offers striking evidence for the contemporary relevance of, among other things, Babbitt's critique of Romanticism. Far from rejecting the existence of something called truth, Kundera attempts in Life as Elsewhere to, his words, bear witness to the reality of what happened when the communists took over his native Czechoslovakia in 1948. The narrator insists that the complicity of literary romanticism with political brutality must not be forgotten. Quote, "What actually remains of that distant time? Today, people regard those days as an era of political trials, persecutions, forbidden books, and legalized murder. But we who remember must bear witness. It was not only an epoch of terror, but also an era of lyricism, ruled hand in hand by the hangman and the poet." Kundera is writing from personal experience, since as a young man, he himself was swept away by the romance of revolution. And like his protagonist, Jaromil, welcomed the communist takeover of Czechoslovakia. Throughout the novel, Jaromil's zeal is fired not by economic or political theories, but because his identification with the revolution allows him to strike romantic poses. It is when his mother embarrasses him by combing his carefully mussed-up hair in front of her friends that he swears eternal allegiance to radical transformation of the world. When Jaromil turns in his girlfriend to the secret police, he is able to justify and even take pride in what he has done because it makes possible a great poem. And here I'm quoting, there's a narrator giving us Jaromil's thoughts. He did not expose his girl to danger because love meant little to him. Quite to the contrary, he wanted to effect a world in which people would love each other more than ever. Yes, that's how it was. Jaromil had risked the safety of his own beloved precisely because he loved her more than other men love their women. Precisely because he knew what love and the bright new world of pure feeling were all about. Of course, it is terrible to sacrifice a concrete living woman, redheaded, petite, talkative, freckle-faced, for the sake of the future world. Such a sacrifice, the only genuine tragedy of our time, was worthy of a great poem. He sat down at his desk and wrote and paced the room, and it seemed to him that the poem he was creating was the greatest he had ever composed. Well, the narrator suggests that the linkage of romantic poetry and communist revolution is not peculiar to Jaromil. After all, quoting, "Through poetry, man realizes his agreement with existence, and rhyme and rhythm are the crudest means of gaining consent. If one asks, can a revolution dispense with repeated affirmation of the new order? Can a revolution dispense with rhyme? The answer is obvious. Certainly, revolutions have no wish to be examined or analyzed. They only yearn to merge with the masses. For that reason, revolutions are lyrical and in need of lyricism." Well, nothing one might have thought could be less interesting or more irrelevant to contemporary events than the criticism of somebody fighting the old literary battle between Romanticism and Classicism. Yet, as long as Romanticism survives, the work of Irving Babbitt will retain its central importance. Communism today persists as official state doctrine only in Cuba, North Korea, maybe China. Romanticism, however, will survive. Babbitt believed that most people, quoting, "always have been, are, and probably always will be, romantic." And when today in the we read in the news that the young allow themselves to become intoxicated and exalted by the thought that they will soon die and in dying kill others, they may be accurately described as romantics, whatever name, other name they or their leaders might use, Muslims, Marxists, nationalists, revolutionaries, whatever. Emil Bergson in Willa Cather's O Pioneers exemplifies the romantic attitude toward death at its most attractive. He was at that height of excitement from which everything is foreshortened, from which life seems short and simple, death very near, and the soul seems to soar like an eagle. As he rode past the graveyard, he looked at the brown hole of a new grave in the earth and felt no horror. That too was beautiful, that simple doorway into forgetfulness. The heart, when it is too much alive, aches for that brown earth, and ecstasy has no fear of death. It is the old and the poor and the maimed who shrink from that brown hole. Its wooers are the young, the passionate, and the gallant-hearted. Well, that suicidal killers may be, or among the young, the passionate, and the gallant-hearted, might be thought not to excuse their crimes, but if it has any moral relevance at all, to provide further grounds for condemning those who exploit youthful generosity in the service of murderous ideologies. Yet, when the custodians of our cultural heritage fail to pass on the traditional wisdom available through humanistic studies, intensity of commitment may seem to trump all other values. and an incapacity or unwillingness to be restrained from murder by an inner check may seem the stuff of heroism. So Irving Babbitt remains important, not only because his thought offers an intellectual framework that furthers our understanding of contemporary masters like Milan Kundera and humane thinkers of the last century like Lionel Trilling or George Santayana, but even more significantly, because his life lets us know that it is possible to confront romanticism in politics and society, as well as in literature, without falling into an extremism that mimics what it opposes. At a time like the present, Irving Babbitt is important, not only as an analyst of the illusions of romanticism, but also as a champion of the unromantic virtues, the qualities so important in everyday life and so disdained by the mass media. Babbitt's humanism remains vital because it is not a doctrine, but a way of life. After all, he said, to be a good humanist is merely to be moderate and sensible and decent. It is much easier for a man to deceive himself and others regarding his supernatural lights than it is regarding the degree to which he is moderate and sensible and decent. Thank you.